Abbey 104.
Hello, good morning. It's Abbey 104 at 11:05 on Sunday morning. It's time for Folk Tales with me, Terry Bennett. And in the studio live this morning, I have Chris Oswald. Good morning, Chris.
Hello, good morning.
Chris, you are an author. That's your main occupation.
Yes, I am. Exactly that. Yes, I've been writing seriously for about 2.5 years now and produced and self-published 5 books. A lot of history-related fiction, following my passion for history and really trying to explore what might have happened as well as what did happen as well.
Oh, interesting. So this is based upon real history, is it? And you project forward to what could have happened if things had not worked the way they
had. Yes, some people call it alternative history or what-if history. So it's really looking at things that might have turned out differently and the way they did. On top of that, I've also written some straight historical fiction, as it were, which is just obviously fiction and history marrying together, and so real people mixing in with made-up people and working out how things might have worked out.
Yeah. And so, how many books do you have so far? You say you've only really been doing it for a couple of years.
Yes, I've written and self-published 5 books. I've written a couple of more, one of which is coming out soon. I just love writing and love history and love putting the two together and making what I hope is a difference.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we'll find out a little bit more about that as we go through the interview, but you haven't always been an author, clearly.
No.
You spent quite a number of years doing other things. What did they include?
Yes, mainly I worked in business for a long time, a lot of time in America, 20-odd years in America with my family. We moved back to Dorset just a few years ago, and that's when I really started the writing.
Okay, let's take your first track, and then we'll come and talk through your life a little. This is John Mayall. Tell us about this track.
I first heard this in 1975 when I was at boarding school, and I just started playing the guitar, and I was playing things like Puff the Magic Dragon and Kumbaya, just strumming chords and things like that. And I heard this record, and I just fell in love with the guitar and realised then that that my guitar playing had to be blues guitar, and I just loved it so much.
We'll be right back. John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, featuring Eric Clapton and Stepping Out from 1966. Chris, that featured Eric Clapton, as I say. Mm. He's a particular favourite, isn't he? Because you've chosen another one from Eric Clapton later.
Yeah, he's... the first time I heard Eric Clapton playing the guitar was that song, actually. And it's just stayed with me the whole time. I love everything he does on the guitar. He's just supremely talented, and I've always loved it. And I've probably got about 40 or 50 Eric Clapton records at home. Oh, so
a decent collection.
Yes.
My guest in the studio today is Chris Oswald, who is a local author, local Sturmester Newton, Chris, I think.
That's right, yes. Yeah. I live in Sturmester Newton.
Let's go right way back to the beginning. And you weren't born in this part of the world, I don't think.
No, I was born in Hampshire, not so far away, actually in Southsea, the seafront of Portsmouth. And I was lived there for a couple of years. We moved around an awful lot because my father was in the Navy. We moved around for about the first 5 or 6 years of my life. Moved to Edinburgh and then Kent and then north of Scotland and then back down to Hampshire, where my mother was basically fed up with moving constantly, and she said, "You move," to her husband, "and we'll stay here." So
fair enough. The ultimate ultimatum, I think.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
We should, at this point, say that yes, your father was in the Navy, but he was in charge of the Navy, actually, wasn't he? He was the First Sea Lord.
Yes, not when I was born, but later on he rose up to be Admiral of the Fleet and First Sea Lord. Yes.
Sir Julian Oswald.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
As you say, it took you all over the place when you were very young. Tell us about that. What sort of places did you end up? In Scotland, I think it was.
Well, we lived in Edinburgh, where one of my sisters was born, and my father's family came from the north of Scotland, so we went up there for a while, and it also took him to Kent, to Welling in Kent, where he was at a particular college there, learning, teaching actually various things. So it took us around quite a lot. He then went off, obviously, and did various things, and it was just an interesting childhood, really. He was away an awful lot. I mean, he was away at sea for the first year of my life, and he was away intermittently. I mean, he worked a lot of the time in the Ministry of Defence in London, so he'd have digs up in London and just come home with the weekends and so on.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about schooling then, because that must have been fairly disrupted at points, was it?
Well, not really, because I first went to school in Hampshire when we settled back in Hampshire, in a little convent in Wickham, and which has since closed down. But it was that was fine. It was just down the road from our house. Didn't get on too well there, in that I was asked to leave at the age of 7. And
That must be quite a remarkable achievement, being asked to leave at the age
of
7.
Yeah, I suppose so. I did a striptease on top of my desk, and while waiting for the teacher to come in. Unfortunately, the teacher came in a little bit too early before I got my clothes back on. And I think that was just the last straw. And
it never going to go down well in a convent school, really.
No, it didn't do too well. But they were very nice about it. And I still know that
they were very nice about expelling you.
Yeah. Well, they were very nice about it. They didn't actually expel me. They suggested that I move on to boarding school a year earlier than my brother went to, for instance, my older brother. So at the age of, I think it was just before my 8th birthday, I went off to boarding school in Lancashire, and spent 11 years there, both at prep school and then on at the senior school.
What do you remember about those days? Because it was obviously away from home. I guess it was expected that you would go to boarding school, was it?
Yes. It was. My father came from that sort of background that children went off to boarding school and that was it, to some extent. But also, it just made it easier in case there was a possibility of them moving again. Sure. So it was just a normal thing for children of military families to do, I think.
And tell us about school. What was it like?
It was boring, to be honest. I rubbed up against all the rules. I wanted to break the rules. I wanted to get out. I wanted to do things. So at the age of 8, there wasn't much you could do. You could run wild and sneak out of school and go down to the river and things like that. But at a later age, I was always the one who sneaked after the pub or to the nightclub or borrowed somebody's car and when I couldn't drive properly, and you know, did all those sort of things that a lot of the people there would never dream of doing. But there was a small group of us that just wanted to experience life, I suppose, and were itching to do things like that.
A bit of a rebel, then.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. One of my first school reports when I was 8 or 9 years old was there was a really nice housemaster called Mr. Ewan, I think it was his name. But he was, he wrote back to my parents that we think we might be able to tame this child. It was that sort of thing where it was just, you knew, there was no boundaries. You just wanted to live life to the full, and you were 8, 10, 12 years old and just wanted to have fun.
Were the school able to cope with that then? Because some institutions, you would have been fairly rapidly finding your way out of them as well, in the same way that you did at primary school.
Yes, give them credit. I wasn't asked to leave that school. I did get into an awful lot of trouble. And I noticed, for instance, for several years in a row, my sleeping arrangements, my cubicle, was always next to the teachers on duty's room, so they wanted to know that, you know, keep under control and make sure that I wasn't doing anything I shouldn't be doing. And
so, in a sense, an enjoyable childhood at school, then, by the sound of it.
Well, no, I think the school was dead boring. So there was nothing to do. I was stuck in the middle of nowhere. Beautiful countryside. Really beautiful countryside, farmland and moors and everything like that up in Lancashire. But there was nothing to do. So you either studied, and I was a terrible student, or you played sport, which I'd played a lot of sport, or else you rebelled. And I did the latter two rather than the first one.
So you got an O-level in rebellion.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You alluded to the academic side of it then, so you didn't do terribly well academically.
Well, no, I did, because I realised that at about the age of 16, when in the O-level year, that I really had to do something, and I didn't want to fail the exams and disappoint my parents and things. So I did buckle down and did quite well.
Must have been some interesting conversations with your parents along the way then, if they were getting reports saying that Chris could do a lot better.
Used to dread the reports coming home, and when they came, my father would call each one of us into the study and go through them, and that was just an awful experience.
So. Something akin to a court-martial.
Yes, it's very similar, I think. Yeah.
The final year then saw you knuckle down and
yes, the final few years. Yeah, I did okay at O-levels and okay at A-levels.
Yes, okay. Mm. With a father high up in the Navy, was the expectation that you would follow him into the forces?
I don't think so. He never put any pressure on us, both my brother or I, or anybody, actually. He seemed... okay, fine for us to do what we wanted to do. His father had been in the Navy as well, so my great grandfather was in the Army, so it was quite a tradition. But he didn't put any pressure on us or anything like that. No.
What were your thoughts then at that point? If you didn't have a specific steer from your father, what were you thinking?
When I left school, I mean, I always loved history. The ability to lose yourself in stories from the past and put yourself in their place was always fantastic. And I always loved that. So I did A-levels, for instance. I did English history and ancient history. So it was a very heavy loading towards history. So I knew that when I went to university, I'd study history, and that's what I applied to. But I wanted a year off, first of all, and I wanted to... go to America, because the other passion of my life was playing guitar and blues music and everything like that. And so from both a historical point of view and a music point of view, I'd been very, very interested in America. So the first thing I did was, when I left school, was jump on a Freddie Laker plane and fly out to Washington.
Right. It seems like an appropriate moment to have your second track, which is The Who and Won't Get Fooled Again.
Yes.
Why this?
Again, because I've always loved The Who. I saw them just after Keith Moon died 1979 for the first time, and I've just always loved them. It's something about that, the British interpretation of the blues music coming over from America, that has always really touched me. So it's the same vein as Eric Clapton, but it's a different type of music, but it's the same interpretation of the old slavery music and African music from America.
Well, it's 8.5 minutes, so we probably won't take all of it, but here's The Who. Who there with Won't Get Fooled Again from 1971, as chosen by my guest in the studio. It's Chris Oswald, who's a local author. Chris, we reached the point where you'd left school, you decided to go to university, and I think you were offered a place at Reading, was that right?
That's right, yes.
But you wanted to take a year out.
Yes.
What was the purpose of that?
Well, mainly because I'd spent 11 years in one educational institution, and I wanted a break. I wanted to do something different. And also, I passionately wanted to go to America. So I flew across to America in the summer of 1979, and then my parents very kindly put me up with various friends, and then friends of friends and friends of friends and things like that. So I didn't spend an awful lot of money on hotels or anything like that, but I hitched around and had a fun time for a couple of months, and went from the East Coast across to the West Coast, ran out of money, and had spent a week in LA, my only week ever in LA, which I was very, very hungry, and it was stifling hot, and I just had no food whatsoever. I was staying with a friend of a friend of a friend in an apartment in LA, and finally, on the about the fourth or fifth day of this starvation diet that I was going through, I stole a piece of old fish from their freezer at the top of their fridge, and cooked it, having no idea how to cook fish or anything like that, and ate it. And the person came back and said, "Who's taken my fish?" And I said, "I took it." And he said, it came out that I hadn't eaten for 4 or 5 days, and he took me out for a really nice Mexican meal and fed me up and paid for it all and everything. So it was that sort of friendliness that really stuck with me. It was a really fun time.
So this was really just a break. You say you obviously had been at school for a long time and needed a break from that before going back into education again. Yeah. So there wasn't any particular aim with that year. You're just going across and experiencing life outside school and getting to know yourself.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then I thought I would work and then travel the following summer, which is what I did.
Did you work in the USA at all?
No. I couldn't get work. No. I suppose you could illegally have got work, but I wasn't permitted to work, so I didn't.
Well, it sounds like a thoroughly enjoyable period of time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
But you had to come back and immerse yourself back in university.
Well, no, first of all, I came back in late 79, and then I got a job, which I always say is the most fun job that I've ever done, which is nursing assistant in a local, to where I was living then, mental hospital. So it was helping a lot of people with dementia and schizophrenia and things like that. I mean, it was doing the basic stuff. It was helping them wash and eat and dress and things like that, and wheeling those around that were in wheelchairs and things like that. But it was definitely a really fulfilling time, and I really enjoyed it. And there was a lot of communication between the different staff members, and a lot of jokes and fun and everything like that. And a lot of the patients there were really interesting people and very sad. But that sort of mixture between sadness and joy, where they've got something positive about their lives, but also something holding them back, and they can't function in society because of that.
That was very temporary, of course. But then it was on to Reading to read history.
History. My first love in terms of academics.
How did that go? Did you apply yourself a little more than you possibly
Well, no,
did?
I slipped back a bit, I'm afraid, because there weren't that many exams. I seem to be very exam orientated. I work hard in a run up to an exam, but I find motivation in terms of studying a bit difficult outside that. But I mean, I was carried by the interest in history. I did a lot of Indian history. A lot of the British in India type history. So a lot of the diplomacy and the military stuff about everything from Napoleonic times through to Second World War.
I'm guessing you enjoyed it university time, though.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, it's fine. Probably the biggest thing is that I met my wife there, who was studying French and German there, Suzanne. And we met in my third year. She was a year behind me. I knew straight away that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with that. Yeah, definitely was love from my point of view, maybe not from her. I met her in a pub, and then spent that evening with her, and then saw her in the library a couple of days later and said, "Would you like to go out?" No.
Ooh.
And No, and I said, would you like to go out on say, Wednesday or something? And she said, no, I can't. What about Thursday? No, I can't. What about Friday? She was very conscientious about her studies, and she had a rota of things that she had to do those nights. So it was about a week before she let me go out with her. And but then we never looked back after that. So,
what happened after university then? You got a degree, and yeah. What was the plan then?
Well, I didn't know what to do all the way through university. So I decided on a complete change and sought adventure, and I applied and got accepted into the Air Force to fly. I actually applied to be a pilot, but got accepted for navigation, and I thought that was probably as close to flying as anything. So I, in 1984, I went off to Cranwell mm-hmm. to do the officer training, and then went up to Finningley, which is now closed down, to do navigation training. I had a lot of fun there, a couple of years there, but unfortunately, both my hearing was not up to it, and also the, I don't know what you call it, but the way you can focus in on one task at a time, my mind, I suppose, wanders a bit, and I found it very, very hard to stay concentrated on one task at a time. So I would get back from these three-hour training sorties, and they'd say, how do you think you did? And I said, wonderful. And they'd say, what about that danger zone that we just, well, if I hadn't diverted the plane, we would have flown through. And that, so I was unaware of it. I was just concentrating on this little thing and thinking that I was doing well, and in fact I wasn't doing very well. I actually came top in the class academically for everything, but couldn't handle the flying. So to that point, they offered me to stay on in a ground role, but I wasn't interested in that. And I was getting quite interested in industry, manufacturing industry as well. You think this is 1985 by then, and it was the boom time after the recession of the early 80s. Yeah. And it was there was a lot of talk about reviving British manufacturing and so on. And I thought I'd like to play a part in that. So I did. I got a series of jobs over the next few years in various businesses. And one of those, a company called Marley PLC, roof tile manufacturer, actually sent me to America for a couple of years in the early 90s, by which time I was married and we had a few children and things. So we went to live on the border between Tennessee and Virginia in a small town, very quaint town, with the oldest theater in America, oldest operating theater in America, had a fun time for a couple of years. Met a lot of nice people and had a good social life and things like that. And then, but the job was dead boring. it was impossible. So I resigned from Marley, and I was seeking. I suppose I've often sought more adventure, hence the Air Force and going off to America and things like that. And I realized that I didn't want to spend all my life being a middle manager in industry. So I decided to try and get into something more adventurous and more involved. And so we came back to England and we moved to Scotland, and I invested as a minority partner in a group of businesses that turned around bankrupt engineering businesses.
You were still quite young, you probably presumably in your 30s at this point.
Yes, 30s,
yeah. With a wife and several children. So
yes.
Quite a big step, really, to take to go outside paid employment and go into something that's a lot more risky.
Yeah, it was. And I have always taken risks. We didn't have an awful lot of money, and what we had went into investing in that business. So it was
this was in Scotland.
In Scotland, yeah.
And how did that business work out then?
It worked out quite well. They had because they bought businesses that were in bankruptcy or close to bankruptcy. So they got them very cheaply, borrowed heavily against them. So it was all highly leveraged. And then they try and turn them around, and some they succeed and some they didn't do so well, and they just ticked over. And but some they made into really good, solid businesses. Mm. And so we spent 5 years on the west coast of Scotland, in a town called Helensburgh, having a lot of fun. There was actually, funny enough, there was a lot of naval connections up there because it was right by the Faslane submarine base. So probably partly because of my father, they all knew my father, who had retired by then, just retired, but partly simply because it was a fun thing. There was a lot of naval officers and a lot of naval people who we got on very well with, and a lot of a really nice social life as well.
Okay. Probably as good a moment as I need to take your third track. This is Neil Young and My My Hey Hey.
Yeah.
Not what I knew, actually. I must admit.
Ah, yeah, lovely.
But, short song. Tell us why.
Simply because it's one of my daughter's favourite songs. And she and I have been to see Neil Young quite often, and went a couple of weeks ago, in fact. And frustratingly, each time we've been to see him, they haven't played this song. He hasn't played this song. But it's just a song that talks about rock and roll, and I think his particular style comes out beautifully in this song.
We'll dedicate it to your daughter.
Thank you.
Thank you. Neil Young and Crazy Horse with My My Hey Hey from 1979, chosen by Chris Oswald, my guest in the studio today. Chris, we left off that you were in Scotland running a business which was trying to rescue companies that were going out of business.
Yes.
But the call of the USA once again came along, didn't it?
Yes. In that this was a European-based group of businesses, and they wanted to set up a American version of it. And I said, well, let me go and do it. I've lived there before. I like the place. And so about, was it 19 years ago now, I was asked to go out and set up a business in America. And myself and the chairman did a couple of trips out to locate places and so on, and we settled on a town in Virginia called Roanoke, which is up in the Blue Ridge Mountains, a very beautiful part of the world, quite a sleepy town, dare I say it, but it turned out to be a good move. And I and the family, which by then consisted of five of our six children, went back out in 2001 and spent 15 years running that business in America. The first thing that happened, though, we went in the summer of 2001, and just after Thanksgiving in November, the chairman came out to see me, and he was the majority shareholder in the business. And his wife had suffered from cancer, and he was getting a lot of hassle from the banks in Germany that were supporting the group of companies. And he said, I've had enough, I'm settling up, I'm cashing in, and do you want to buy this business? And the business was in startup mode. It had sales of $10,000 a month and expenses of about $30,000 a month, so it wasn't viable. But I ended up paying a dollar for it, which I don't think I've actually ever paid. So I owe somebody a dollar. I took on this emerging business, which was exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to be even more entrepreneurial than this group was. And it was a very, very sort of risky but exciting time trying to make this business viable, and we went hell for leather to increase our sales and so on. And we eventually made a successful business because we started getting into defense sales, which this group had of companies in Scotland-based companies had stayed away from largely, not entirely, but largely. And we started making these complicated automation products for aircraft carriers, American aircraft carriers. So we went from a struggling $2 million a year business to a business where we got $40 million of orders in 1 week. But then, of course, it took 5 years to fulfill those orders. And then every 6 years or 7 years, they build an aircraft carrier. So we had this terrible gap between. So that became the new thing to have to try and sort out. How you fill that gap without laying everybody off and rehiring when the next contract came along. So we muddled through all that and had a lot of fun times and a lot of scary times when we didn't know where we were going to make the wages bill. And sometimes we didn't. Sometimes we got cut off on health insurance and had to reinstate it with a late payment and so on. So it was a looking back now, it's not something I'd want to do forever, but it was a good fun time to do that.
And all the time you're based in Virginia?
Yes.
Nice place to live?
Yeah, it's very nice. Very community orientated. A lot of the people there don't travel an awful lot. So it wasn't very international at all. It's not like New York or Washington or something like that. It's much smaller, but it's very parochial, very. It's on the northern fringes of the Bible Belt, so everybody went to church, and it's mostly Baptists. and people had a very conservative and fundamental view of life. But it was nice. It was interesting. Mm.
It must therefore have been quite a difficult decision eventually in 2017 when you came to sell the business. What prompted that?
Well, it was really... what happened is that we had our sixth child while living in America, and shortly after, when he was just under 3 years old, he was diagnosed with autism. And that autism started off fairly mildly, but over the last 9, 10, 12 years, it's got severely worse and progressively worse. And Roanoke, in Virginia itself, was not a place to live with an autistic child. I mean, not with mildly autistic children, I think they could get by, but somebody who is deteriorating and has a lot of behavior, not violent behavior, but a lot of difficulty in living a normal life. It's not a good place. They're just not well equipped for that. So we bought a house in Dorset a few years back earlier, and we had a choice of whether to move to Dorset or to try and move to Massachusetts. And the only reason for moving to Massachusetts was that it had good care for autism. But we couldn't really afford a third house on top of the two we had. So we came back to Dorset, and very happily. It sounds like we're forced back to Dorset, but we're not. We'd loved, from when we bought the house in 2006, I think it was, we very much loved Dorset. We used to come back here every Christmas and every summer and so on. So we moved back to Dorset, and then I sold the business shortly afterwards, mainly because I very much wanted to write, and I was getting increasingly interested in writing.
We're running a little bit short of time, so let's just take your penultimate track, and then we'll talk all about your writing career after that. This is Bob Dylan and Tangled Up in Blue. Why this?
Because, again, it was one of those ones when I got this album when it first came out in 1975, and I played it until it was worn out. I mean, I just played it and played it and played it. It's now scratched and useless, but I just particularly love this song. It's so emotive. It's so talks to the soul that I really, really loved it.
Early one morning, the sun was shining. I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like Mama's homemade dress. Papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through, tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force. We drove that car as far as we could, abandoned it out west, split up on the docks at night, both agreeing it was best. And she turned around to look at me as I was walking away. I heard her say over my shoulder, we'll meet again someday on the avenue. Job in the great north woods, working as a cook for a spell, but I never did like it all that much, and one day the axe just fell. So I drifted down to New Orleans, where I lucky with a be employed, working for a while on a fishing boat right outside of Delacroix. But all the while I was alone, the past was close behind. I seen a lot of women, but she never escaped my mind, and I just grew blue.
Well, we're going to have to fade out Bob Dylan there as Tangled Up in Blue from 1975, because we wanted to get back to our guest, who is Chris Oswald. And Chris, we got to the point where you had decided to sell the business in Virginia. You mm-hmm. came back and bought a property. Well, you already had the property in Dorset.
Yeah.
And what happened next? You had an interest in writing, but that's where that all started. Yeah.
Yes, yes. I've always been interested in writing. And at school, for instance, I used to win essay competitions and things like that. So I always knew I was okay at it. Going back to the mid-90s, when I had that dead-end job in America, I had nothing to do, so not much to do. So I wrote a couple of books and in the office time. And they were dreadful, but you have to start somewhere. And I then came back to it off and on over the years, but mainly the stress of running businesses and being up a family was too much. So I just come to it once a month and write a couple of pages and then have to put it aside. But when I sold the business, or in the run-up to selling the business, I had more time. So I really decided that that's what I wanted to do. And so the first book I wrote in this session is 2024 History of the Future, which is actually a what-if type scenario if Brexit didn't work out. But this, funnily enough, this is something I wrote. I wrote in a first version back in the 90s, and it was a trying to get out of the European Union at that time, and it was the resistance and clamp down on people who were trying to resist the all-powerful European Union, a bit like a Big Brother type thing. And so I rewrote it from memory in 2016 and 17, and then published it. And then very quickly followed that with another book that I'd started writing and wrote called 18 Acres of England, which is another what-if historical type of book, which is looking at... it also has a few political issues in, like, imprisonment in America, which or the need for prison reform in America, which is something I feel quite strongly about, and slavery, and... Also, but the fundamental book, tenet of the book is what if American independence hadn't happened, but it'd been covered up. And so America developed as a separate country, but actually legally it was still owned by the British Empire. So there's a lot of room for discord and suspense there.
When you came into writing then, you weren't an established author, clearly. So yeah. How did you go about persuading people to publish these books?
Well, I self-publish. I get them all proofread and covers designed, and I publish them myself, and I do the promoting and the marketing and myself. Okay. I've made lots of mistakes and printed out books and then seen glaring mistakes in them and everything like that. So it's a rocky road, but it's I decided to do that partly in patience, partly just wanting to get on with it and not wanting to sit around and approach agents for 5 or 10 years and eventually in my 70s be taken on by somebody. And so I really wanted to just get on and get the books out there. Not that I don't want to have an agent, I'd love to have an agent, but I just concentrated on getting the books out there.
So it sounds like you're now living the dream, as it were, in fact you're doing a job that you really enjoy.
Yes.
And is that the plan to carry on writing now? Is that?
Yeah. 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 In particular, I started the Dorset Chronicles series, which is straight historical fiction. So it's not what if something worked out differently. It's set in the late 17th century and it's set in Dorset. And so that's marrying together quite a few things that I really enjoy, the history, the Dorset, Dorset local history, and fiction as well. So writing a lot of sort of good stories, but in a historical context. And I chose the late 17th century because that's a period of enormous change. A lot of people write about the Civil War earlier in the 17th century and the Tudors and Stuarts the previous century, but I wanted to write about 1685 onwards through to 1730 or so, when there was a huge amount of change. And I term it, this is when our modern nation was formed. So the Dorset Chronicles, two books have been released. The third book, called A Simple Mistake, is coming out next week. And that's the third book in the series. I envisage this being 20 or 30 or even maybe even more books over that period. So it's tracing people who are young in 1685 and their lifetimes, basically. So through to 1730 or 1740 even. And the way that they and the nation's history get entangled and wound up together.
So there's quite a few more in that series,
yes,
potentially.
Yeah, so that's going to keep me busy for quite a while.
How do you promote your books?
I do social media. I do book signings. So I'm always phoning up local literary societies and bookshops and asking if I can come along. And so far I've had a good reception to those. I've done a book signing in W.H. Smith's in Sherborne, for instance. The books are available in W.H. Smith and also in Winston's in Sherborne. I'm spreading out gradually. I'm taking the books to bookshops and talking about them and persuading the owner or the manager to take them on. And stressing the Dorset connection of the later books as well.
And Chris, sadly, we're going to have to end there, but we wish you luck in that continuing career with your books, and come back and talk to us again about it.
I'd love to. Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to go out with your final track, which is a bit more Eric Clapton.
Yes, it's so.
This is Layla, the yeah. famous unplugged version. And, well, you've already said that he's a great favourite, isn't he?
Yes, yes, enormous favourite.
Chris, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. Say we'll never.
me on my knees, Layla. Begging, darling, please, Layla. Darling, won't you ease my worry now? Layla, got me on my knees, Layla. Begging, darling, please, Layla. Darling, won't you?